From the Battle of Waterloo to the Franco-Prussian War, the Rothschilds knew no rivals, but the gold which victorious Germany exacted from France enabled the Bleichroeder Mendelssohn Group to enter the field against them. During the interval between the Franco-Prussian War and that of 1914, the rival groups fought each other on the economic and industrial field with a few minor armed conflicts in between. The most fertile field of the Bleichroeder Mendelssohn Group outside of Germany was in the United States. From the Versailles Treaty onwards, the game of the adversaries has been played cautiously, but the Rothschild Group was not granted a large quantity of gold as a war indemnity. Many curious events since the war can be more easily explained if one keeps in view the struggle going on in the world of finance. The United States, for example, as one of the main bases of the Bleichroeder Mendelssohn Group, not only claims payments from France, but seeks at the same time to decrease those due to France from Germany. Insofar as the accumulation of gold is an indication of strength, the Rothschilds are not beaten. It is true that, on the other hand, their adversaries have let loose Bolshevism in Spain, one of the Rothschilds' fiefs that revolutions have broken out in South American countries, where their interests were paramount, that Australia has been badly upset financially, and so on. To defend themselves, the Rothschilds have withdrawn into their coffers in France, Belgium, Switzerland, and Holland all the gold that they had in the countries which had revolted against them, namely England and the United States. Their enemies have made use of these two last-named powers, especially in order to bring about the ruin and fall of the dynasty that has ruled Europe since the Battle of Waterloo. The abandonment of the gold standard would seem to indicate a triumph for the anti-Rothschild group. It must, however, not be forgotten that the two groups are aiming at absolute control of the international bank, which, thanks to its possession of the world's gold, its mastery over raw material, and its grip upon industry, will be able to decree the inauguration of a system of international currency. And when the victory over the non-Jews is complete, an understanding can be arrived at. As Mr. Belloc pithily expresses it, quote, "It is so with those great financial monopolists who alone hold the real powers in the modern world. They will fight one against the other. Now one will fall, but as against the outer world, he remains one of us to the others. He is still bidden to think in millions, and 10 to 1, if he lives, he will be restored." End of quote. The ruthless, unchecked competition of Calvinist or Puritan capitalism has, in highly industrial countries, tended towards the concentration of capital in the hands of the relatively few. The holders of industrial capital are in their turn dependent for their power to work it on those who have the giving or refusing of the financial credit, without which no use can be made of it. The bankers, of course, will advance financial credit where there is the best prospect of the quickest return through the agency of prices of the principal advance plus the interest. Some results of all this on society are worth noting. One is the furious rhythm of all modern life in the pursuit of money. Another is what Mr. H. Belloc, in Economics for Helen, calls the capitalist paradox, which is that capitalism is a way of producing wealth which, in the long run, prevents people from obtaining the wealth produced and prevents the owner of the wealth from finding a market. A third is the paralysis of exchange and commerce, when those who give credit are fighting amongst themselves for supremacy, the stake being the overlordship of the world. All these evils have been pointed out in unforgettable language by Pope Pius XI. Quote, "It is patent that in our days not only is wealth accumulated, but immense power and despotic economic domination is concentrated in the hands of a few, and that those few are frequently not the owners, but only the trustees and directors of invested funds who administer them at their good pleasure. This power becomes particularly irresistible when exercised by those who, because they hold and control money, are able also to govern credit and determine its allotment, for that reason supplying, so to speak, the lifeblood to the entire economic body and grasping, as it were, in their hands, the very soul of production, so that no one dare breathe against their will. This accumulation of power, the characteristic note of the modern economic order, is a natural result of limitless free competition, which permits the survival only of those who are the strongest, which often means those who fight most relentlessly, who pay least heed to the dictates of conscience. This concentration of power has led to a threefold struggle for domination. First, there is the struggle for dictatorship in the economic sphere itself. Then the fierce battle to acquire control of the state so that its resources and authority may be abused in the economic struggles. Finally, the clash between states themselves. This latter arises from two causes. Because the nations apply their power and political influence, regardless of circumstances, to promote the economic advantages of their citizens, and because, vice versa, economic forces and economic domination are used to decide political controversies between peoples. You assuredly know, venerable brethren and beloved children, and you lament the ultimate consequences of this individualistic spirit in economic affairs. Free competition is dead. Economic dictatorship has taken its place. Unbridled ambition for domination has succeeded the desire for gain. The whole economic life has become hard, cruel, and relentless in a ghastly measure. End of quote.